Risky Business, your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray. Updating Tuesdays on itradio.com.au.
Hello and welcome to Risky Business number 68, sponsored this week by Checkpoint Software and hosted, as always, by Vigabyte Virtual Hosting. On this week's show, we're talking web application firewalls with Jeremiah Grossman. He's the founder and CTO of White Hat Security, and he's also a semi-regular guest on Risky Business. This week, we're talking to Jeremiah about WAFs, or web application firewalls. He says they come in quite handy, and of course he's biased, having done some work on WAFs with his company White Hat and F5, but he provides some pretty compelling arguments as to why these things are an asset. It turns out it takes the typical organisation around 130 days to fix a SQL injection bug in code. But you can mitigate these sorts of things with a web app firewall, and you won't even have to deal with the development team. Hooray! So Jeremiah will be along with that interview shortly. We'll also hear from Checkpoint's Steve McDonald in this week's sponsor interview. He says the enterprise market is cottoning on to the idea that letting staff bring their own laptops to work isn't necessarily a terrible thing. When you think about it, any laptop that leaves the office is going to be a risk. You simply can't trust it. So why not just go all out and let staff bring in any old lump of crap? Chuck it on a dirty old VLAN and let it access what it has to and what it has to only. Do some fancy stuff with endpoint health checking and 802.1x. And in other words, just assume laptops connecting to your network are always hostile. Now, normally we'd start off the show by chatting with ZDNet Australia's editor Munir Kataria, but we can't do that this week because Mun's crook and can't even chat to us. He's at home resting up. So get well soon, mate, if you're listening. And instead, we've got this week Adam Metalstorm Boileau filling in for him on the show. Adam's the organiser of the KiwiCon Hacking Conference, which is back on this year in September. Go to kiwicon.org for more information. He's also the genius, the evil genius behind WinLockPwn, which is the code that will help you unlock a Windows workstation through the FireWire port. He's a freelance security consultant, pen tester, developer and bug hunter, and he joins me now. Now, Adam, in news that's sure to make you Kiwis chuckle your heads off at us poor Australians across the ditch, the Queensland State Government's e-tenders website has been massively pwned.
Yes, well, you know, government stuff getting hacked always does make us lol.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, no one really seems to know what's happened here from the reporting that we've seen, though.
No, well, I guess they're obviously keeping it under wraps. I mean, you always assume that it's probably just some, you know, web kiddie defacement and that they're just hideously embarrassed, but, you know, it could always be worse than that.
Well, I suspect it may be. Now, this is just speculation at this point, but the fact is it's still down, the site, so they're actually shunting all of their tenders through the New South Wales state government tendering system, which I suppose for international listeners, we should explain that there's a lot of rivalry between Queensland and New South Wales. So it's just, you know, quite hilarious to have Queensland passing all of their tenders through to the New South Wales system. And the other thing is it didn't pop up on the Zone H defacement archive, which makes me suspect that there may have been something a little bit more sinister going on.
Yeah, well, it's entirely possible. Yeah. I mean, Zone H, of course, is not the most reliable source, but, you know, usually get Turkish web defacement kiddies and that's all. But if it was something amusing and just your average run-of-the-mill defacement, you there's a reasonable chance it would turn up there. And if it didn't, then yeah, maybe it's time to start, you know, getting your conspiracy theory out.
Well, I just suspect maybe they're doing a proper forensic recovery on that box, which is why it isn't back online immediately. You know, that's what's got me wondering.
Yeah, it's a pity that they're never going to release the results or something like that, even though it's your public money they're spending.
Well, you never know. I mean, something might come to light later. I mean, they might refer some charges to the DPP. I've heard of cases, I think in the US, I could be wrong, could have been Europe somewhere, where public tender systems have actually been hacked into and manipulated before.
Yeah, well, of course, there's big money involved and, seems to make sense if you're, you know, not quite so scrupulous about how you tender for these things.
Yeah, okay. Well, I think at this stage, I'm ready to say that we'll just keep an eye on this one and see what happens. Okay, now Mark Dowd has promised to obliterate built-in security measures for Windows Vista at his upcoming presentation at Black Hat.
Yeah, well, that certainly sounds like interesting stuff. I mean, obviously, you know, the weaknesses in the ASLR and the DEP stuff, I mean, have been used in the past. But if you've got some kind of, you know, systematic or, robust way of getting around those that isn't specific to each exploit you're doing, then that would be very interesting.
Yeah. It looks like it's, you know, he's found some generic ways around, or there might even be attack-specific ways around some of the protections like data execution prevention and address-based layout randomization. It looks like he's going to do some stuff that'll make the guys in Redmond quite unhappy.
Yeah, I mean, one of the other things, I mean, I read some of the media articles about what he's going to talk about, and one possibility, given the work he's been doing on Flash lately, is that he's going to be talking about injecting managed code or attacking the actual virtual machines that are running managed code, like Flash or .NET or whatever, places where data is meant to be code, you know, where DEP doesn't buy you anything and where ASLR doesn't matter because the VM's taking care of it for you. So that's another thing he might be talking about. I know, I'm speculating though.
Yeah, well, we love speculation. It is risky business. The funny thing is we actually had Mark Dowd on the show about 6 or 7 weeks ago and he hinted at this stuff before this story was written. I'll play you the quote down the line.
I'm probably going to be looking further into various protection mechanisms and stuff, specifically on the Windows platforms. The runtime protection mechanisms and stuff. I'll probably be giving a talk on that kind of thing like later in the year, maybe Black Hat or something like that.
So you're about to make some guys in Redmond very unhappy?
They love it, really, you know.
They like it rough.
Yeah.
So there you go, Adam. Microsoft apparently likes it rough.
Well, yes they do. Yeah, well, it certainly does sound like he's talking about, you know, generic ASLR or DEP. Bypass, which, you know, that would be a very handy thing for everybody.
Well, yeah, except the people who are trying to lock down the systems, you know. Very handy for all the mayhem makers like you, I'm sure.
Although, actually, I noticed his Black Hat talk was entitled something like How to Impress Girls with Browser Memory Bypass. That's what makes me think maybe that it is, like if he specifically mentions browsers.
Oh, you mean that it could be about loading up nasty stuff in Flash and various other plugins?
You think of Flash and JavaScript?
Yeah.
Rather than platform-level stuff, you know, rather than low-level OS-level stuff, but, you know, then again.
Well, there was actually a portion of that interview. I think it was Risky Business 60. I'm not sure. I mean, people can go and Google for that. When we actually spoke to Mark and about his Flash bug, which was, you know, quite impressive. And we did really have a chat about some generic problems that you can find in high-level languages, which, you know, can be a little bit spooky. So it wouldn't surprise me.
Well, anywhere where code and data mix, you know, is a place that you need to look, because then it can bypass the, you know, the platform level protections. And yeah, things like the VMs are exactly the sort of place where we would find that sort of thing.
Now, speaking of Microsoft and trying to lock down their OS, they have actually issued some new tools to assist ASP and ASP.NET developers actually lock down certain types of bugs like SQL injection. You know, some may say about time, others may say, well, it's not their fault, that developers are idiots. But what do you make of this, Adam?
Well, I guess, you know, any tool that makes the developers not do really, really dumb stuff is good. I mean, if we saw less websites where, you know, sticking a single quote in the search box bust it, you know, that would be a good thing. But to be honest, you know, there's automated tools out there that cost real money made by, you know, commercial companies whose business, you know, rides on the quality of these tools that are also shit. So, you know, I don't have a lot of faith in automated scanning tools and picking up the real issues.
What I will say is this, which is that, you know, anything that can get rid of those really basic, trivial SQL injection bugs, it's got to be a good thing. Because you remember there was that big worm that came around recently, or it was an automated attack. It hosed something like 500,000 IIS boxes.
Yes, well, I mean, anything that takes care of the easy stuff is good. But so long as we don't actually believe these tools are going to cover off everything. I mean, if you look at, say, the antivirus industry, where it's, you know, it's supposed to be mature, do we actually believe that antivirus stops viruses and worms? No, not really.
AV seems to have hit that critical point. We've been saying for a couple of years now, you know, AV is losing its effectiveness, and it seems to have completely lost its effectiveness over the last year or so.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And I mean, I guess I'm comparing the very immature web application security scanning tool market to the relatively mature AV market and saying, well, why is web app scanning going to be better than AV? If anything, you know, spotting web app bugs is more complex than spotting viruses. Oh, no, maybe not. Maybe that's bollocks. I don't know. But, The maturity of the tools doesn't make me feel particularly confident about them. So, you know, immature free tools from Microsoft don't make me feel good either.
Yeah, well, in this week's show, we're talking to Jeremiah Grossman. He's our feature interview. And we're having a chat about web application firewalls next. And much to my surprise, they're not actually completely useless. So there you go.
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, there are some things that you can do, of course, to make things better. But, you know, do we really think it's going to protect against the real actual bad threats as opposed to, you know, script kiddies from Turkey?
Well, what I think is funny is most high profile breaches these days are just low hanging fruit. Oh, no, I said it now. Oh, God, I said low hanging fruit on my own show. You know, most of them are getting pwned by really trivial vulnerabilities, but or they're just losing the data. They're leaving it in the back of bloody taxis and stuff on laptops. Don't you think if we just do get rid of the easy stuff, it will actually make it considerably harder for the bad guys?
No, I think that we're just not hearing about the bad hacks. The data breach disclosure laws are not effective.
Well, that's actually a story that we're going to cover in a minute. But before we do that, this one I think is particularly relevant to an Australian audience because we're going through all sorts of revamps of our transport systems, both in Melbourne and Sydney. But a Dutch researcher rode for free on the London transit system, having hacked the public transit's card system.
Yeah, now I thought this story is really interesting. A, because the reporting of it was a little strange. Like, they talk about the guy, like the big deal is the guy riding on the train free. I was like, well, to be honest, whoop the fucking do. I've ridden on the trams in Melbourne for free by accident almost. I think the really interesting thing about this story is the techniques that they used to attack those cards. I don't know if you've actually read the paper itself that they released, but what they actually did was they decapped the RFID chip, looked at it with an optical microscope, wrote software to reconstruct the layout of the gates on the chip, and then from there reverse engineered the proprietary crypto algorithm, and then cryptanalyzed the proprietary crypto algorithm and found weaknesses in it, right? This is awesome stuff, right? I mean, if you were a nerd, you'd be at home over this right now.
Yeah, I might be, but some hardcore reverse engineering here, right?
Absolutely, right. That's the really cool thing about this attack, right? I mean, the fundamental problem here is homegrown shitty crypto. Because companies implement it in hardware, they think that somehow that they can get away with that. But you put a billion devices out there, then some bored grad student, in this case without even an electron microscope, with a plain optical microscope, will do a PhD about how to bust your stuff.
Yeah. So this was a smart card system, wasn't it, or was it actually RFID?
This was an RFID smart card, like a contactless smart card. So it's both.
Yeah, okay. Now, what I find interesting about this, and I've got to disagree with you on one thing, Adam, which is I understand the angle of that story being that someone was able to use a card on London's transport system, because if you're looking at this from a high level, I've got a lot of listeners in government. Hi, guys, and they're the people who have to consider the security of systems like this. And really, the fact that people can actually clone these cards and ride for free, that's a problem. That is a serious problem. I mean,
well, it's more of a problem when you also use those things for building access control or e-passports or anything else where you expect the integrity of smart cards to be maintained.
Well, I think this is where document security comes into it. You've got to have your fancy printed paper. You've got to have your holographic seals. You've got to make it as hard as you possibly can for anyone to be able to reproduce a document. But it's just looking increasingly like we can't rely on the integrity of the electronic component of any of these things.
Well, I think if they had used standard, public peer-reviewed crypto, then they wouldn't be in the circumstance. Like, then it wouldn't matter that someone could reverse engineer the chip with a microscope. If you use decent crypto, then you can protect yourself even in an electronic implementation.
Yeah, now this, of course, is the Oyster system, which is used on London's transit system. So pwned. Yeah. I'm actually off to Amsterdam, by the looks of things, to the GovCert conference there in the Netherlands. Those guys have been kind enough to invite me to come over, and they're really looking at this stuff at the moment in the Netherlands. So I'm going to come back with a swag of news on that. But one thing that it's got me thinking about is I remember when I was a teenager, these guys that I knew actually came up with a special solution. It was like a watered-down bleach solution that they could use to get the ink off the weekly Met cards, right, in Melbourne. And they'd actually rub the stamped expiry date off these things. And, of course, they'd have their own stamps. So they could get, 6 months out of one thing. And that was just bypassing the document security thing. So, I mean, I think eventually what we're going to need is a combination of good document security, like, good inks stamped on things that are, resistant to bleach coming off and things like that. And of course, some sort of electronic component as well with good crypto. I mean, do you agree with that?
Well, I think that there's a lot of value that people don't really think about in low kind of small scale micro fraud, for very low value things that aren't worth protecting, like public transport tickets or parking tickets or that sort of thing. Like, you think about the thermally printed prepay parking tickets you have to get. Like, you could print those off yourself, no problem. Like, they have absolutely zero document security. And I think students are the main people who are going to be interested in this sort of thing. But yeah, I think low scale micro fraud is going to be a growing area of kind of casual crime.
Micro-fraud, that's an interesting term. I'd not heard that before. But yeah, so I guess we're all going to start investing in those little wax printers, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, sounds good. All right, now, this is an interesting piece here. Visa has is testing these one-time password cards, right? And they're kind of cool. They look like a normal credit card. They've got like a little keypad on them as well. And you have to enter a PIN before it will display a one-time code.
I think that's great. Anything that makes two-factor auth easy and more available and more convenient for end users is a good thing, in my opinion.
Oh, it's great. I mean, it goes on the card, but what I think is really interesting, RSA, which is a sponsor of this show, I need to disclose that, they have a card that actually has a, you know, it's got a token built into it. But this one, you actually have to enter the passcode. You have to enter a PIN onto the card before it'll even display the one-time passcode. I think that's a pretty clever little twist on the token idea, isn't it?
Well, I mean, it means you've got two-factor auth in the card itself, right? You've got having the card and knowing the PIN, whereas with an RFID thing, you're only getting one extra factor from the RSA token.
Yeah. So you think this is a good idea?
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. The only thing that concerns me, obviously, is more complexity is bad. But really, it just sounds like banks and card issuers responding to their incentives to care about fraud. You know, it costs them money, and they're looking for ways to fix it, and I think that's great.
Now, in this last piece, which comes from Robert Lemos of Security Focus in the US, he's written that data breach notification laws passed by many states there have actually failed. They haven't really done anything in terms of producing a measurable impact on identity theft.
Well, I mean, I think that's probably the wrong conclusion to draw. I mean, personally, my instinct is that data breach notification laws are absolutely the right way to address the problem. And the fact that they're not working yet is either because we don't have enough other data, like how much identity theft was happening before and how much is happening now, or because it just hasn't really sunk in that people have to report data breaches. I mean, I've done a lot of incident response, and I don't think I've ever seen any one of those reported to anybody ever. I'm pretty skeptical about what percentage of data breaches get reported, and so I'm skeptical of any conclusion drawn from those kind of statistics.
What I also find myself wondering, if these laws weren't in place, how many extra notifications there would be, you know? I mean, I think it is a little bit difficult to get the trending information on this.
It just seems obvious that data breach notification is the only real tool that we have to make businesses accountable. Like, it's the only real cost to them is bad publicity. And if they don't have to tell anyone, there's no incentive for them to fix it. And I think the sooner we have a public wall of sheep for people getting owned and doing dumb stuff, the better.
All right, mate. Well, look, that's actually going to bring us to the end of the news segment. But before we go, I understand that, you know, most likely by the time Risky Business 69 rolls around next week, you're going to be a daddy.
That's what I hear.
You have an explosively pregnant missus at home, don't you?
I do indeed. She looks like the front of a jet plane.
Excellent. She's what, 12 days overdue, right?
Yeah, she is. So any day now.
Any day now, little metal spawn will say hello.
Yes, indeed. Well, yeah, hopefully another hacker on the way, huh?
Sounds great, mate. Well, we wish you the best of luck with that. Hope
I imagine I am going to need it.
Yeah, enjoy your last sleep while you can over the next couple of days. And
yes, indeed.
And thank you very much for coming on to the Risky Business, undoubtedly last time as a non-parent. And we'll chat to you again soon, Adam. Thanks again.
Not a problem. Thanks very much.
That was New Zealand's Adam Boileau on the line there with this week's news headlines. We discussed stories that appeared on securityfocus.com and on the Australian Financial Review and ZDNet Australia websites, so you can follow up those stories there if you are so inclined. It's time now for this week's feature interview, a chat with Jeremiah Grossman from White Hat Security about web application firewalls. Jeremiah is very well known in the field of web application security, and his blog has become compulsory reading for web app boffins worldwide, and he joins me now. Welcome back to the show for your third appearance.
Thank you, Patrick. It's good to be here.
Now, look, we've learned something interesting about you recently, which is of particular interest to an Australian audience, which is that you're actually a keen AFL fan, and you play.
In the Bay Area here, there's something called the Golden Gate Australian Rules Football League. There's four teams in the league. It's very big here. It's about 50% Australian, 50% American, and I picked it up about 3-4 years back. Been playing ever since. I love it. One of the dreams in life is to make it out to Australia one day and get in a game somewhere. That'll be a good highlight.
Well, no, you can't just go somewhere. You have to go to the Melbourne Cricket Ground, which is the spiritual home of the game. I'm afraid that's absolutely where you must wind up. Okay, now, Jeremiah, today we're going to talk about web application firewalls. Now, this concept has been around for a while, but it's how do they work? Are they basically like one of those things that you put in front of your web server, they learn what's normal by watching the requests come in, and then they start blocking anything outside of that?
Generally speaking, if you don't put a web application firewall into block mode, it's kind of a web server or web application IDS more than it's a firewall at that point. If it blocks, then it can be made, then that's where you get the web application firewall term from.
Okay, so what sort of stuff, I mean, okay, it inspects HTTP requests, right? So what is it looking for, like cross-site request forgery stuff? Is it looking for, you know, funny symbols in form data? What sort of attacks can this thing actually catch?
It depends on the design and the configuration setup. So in a positive security model, somebody manually or through a learning engine, it'll say, this website only expects to receive this stuff in these places. You know, first names are only supposed to receive these characters, or credit card numbers must look like this. Anything that falls outside of the norm just gets dropped, whether it's an attack or anything else, and which has some good points security-wise, but also runs the risk of blocking legit traffic. Then there's the polar opposite of that, when they run in a negative security model, where they're more looking at general attacks, specific attacks, or general attack themes. You know, a SQL injection attack might have a select star in it, so there'd be signature matching, or even something as a single quote. So it's a bit looser and easier to bypass from a security standpoint, but it's a little bit more forgiving when it comes to, you know, when it might block legit user traffic.
So how do these differ from an actual IDS or IPS? Why would you, you know, what actually separates a web application firewall? Does it actually run on the host, or does it run on a box in front of the host, or...?
It can actually run in a lot of different ways. It can run as a reverse proxy, an out-of-band bridge. Even in the case of mod security and URL scan, they can actually run on the web server itself. And all of them are, you know, there's nothing, either of them have their pros and cons. It just depends on what style you're running. But when it comes to comparing them against, you know, traditional IDS, you know, IDS looks at network traffic, IP and TCP traffic, and a little bit of a web application. What the web application firewalls do is they are very good at parsing HTTP and setting policies and controls around what is good or bad HTTP traffic.
Now, it's funny, you actually mentioned the fact that these web application firewalls can be trained to learn. You know, you put them in front of your network and you say, you know, you profile some normal traffic and then you switch it on. I just want to play you now a little quote from a presentation done at the KiwiCon security conference last year by a guy called Declan Ingram. And this is Declan talking about a self-learning IPS, essentially the same thing, right, that you put in front of your network. So,
sure.
So here's Declan.
The other thing to think about is that it's normal for your networks to be under attack. So when you, like, normally you go, okay, we're going to implement an intrusion prevention system throughout our enterprise. Our enterprise, what a great word. And then we're going to leave it for 6 weeks. Before we turn anything on. We're just going to leave it and just watch. And then in that time, it'll work out what's normal. And in that time, dudes are doing dodgy things. They're surfing porn. They're downloading BitTorrents. Dudes are hacking you. There are root shells going back and forth. Your database is traveling over to China, etc., etc., etc. And then you click the, yep, go for it, that's normal button. What a good day's work. I'm going to go and have a coffee.
So... Do you think
that's great, actually.
Do you think Declan makes a valid point there, though, that these self-learning devices are flawed in that your network really is always under attack and your application really is always under attack? So determining what quote-unquote, you know, normal traffic is quite hard.
Oh, yeah, it actually is really hard. It's, you know, websites will, you know, the more popular a website or the more valuable it is, it will be under attack all the time. So learning in a lot of ways is a dark and mysterious art. No one quite knows the algorithms or quite knows how it works. But it can be used to tune up a positive security model rather quickly. It's definitely not going to be perfect, and it's going to need a human gray matter to massage the rest. But when it comes to learning engines and web application firewalls, I'm not so sure about the IDS, pure IDS world, but when it comes to websites, the learning engines, it's not so much the attacks messing up the learning engine, it's the sites changing because it has to rebuild the positive security model. So if you're changing your site every 2 weeks, it's going to be learning all the time. And like Declan said, you know, if you wait 6 weeks after every single change, well, you're never going to get it out of IDS mode and get into block mode.
Yeah. Look, I mean, that's absolutely true. And we all know how much developers love it when security teams give them change control procedures that are really complicated.
So the learning is good to try to get to that first pass positive security model. But the real struggle is if you have a static website and you're learning in a QA environment or even in the production environment, with a learning engine, you can probably get the positive security models quite right. It's just when they change a lot, it gets really problematic.
Yeah. I suppose, though, that it wouldn't be too much of a hassle for, say, like some sort of e-commerce organization, because really if you're going for your PCI compliance, you pretty much have to have some stringent controls around change management and uploading new code to servers in the first place. So maybe not such a difficult thing to do to mesh that change control between the security group managing the web application firewall and the developers.
Well, what we're finding, at least in the work we do at White Hat, right, we assess all these websites for a living, and the e-commerce sites are changing all the time, you know, holidays, weekends, specials, they're changing code all the time, daily, definitely weekly or twice per week. Usually it's the financial and insurance applications that are changing less often, and usually the bigger they are, the less they change.
Another thought that strikes me about this is that the web application firewall could almost be seen as more of a last line of defense. You know, it's like if there really is something bad that the developers have let through to the keeper, so to speak, the web application firewall might have a chance of catching it. But in and of itself, it's not really designed to be a particularly effective defense. Is that kind of where they sit?
It depends on how you look at the problem. So, you know, I've worked in the enterprise quite often, and I work with companies on the enterprise a lot. So I've always been a proponent of situational awareness. I want to know what I'm vulnerable to, and then I have options. If I know what my problems are, then I can go about the process of fixing it. If the fix is in the code, great. If it's going to take 6 months, then I'm going to put a WAF in place and put some intelligence in there to block what I know about. Is it going to be perfect? No, but it might wipe out, you know, half, you know, 10%, 20%, or maybe nearly all of them, depending. And then I can start whittling down my problem set and focusing on those. So, you know, the first and last line of defense is almost a misnomer. It's just an option the IT security guy has because the developers don't work for him.
Mm-hmm. Who are the vendors who are really active in this space?
The big ones that, let's say, it depends. So if you're looking, you know, for PCI, smaller SME shop, you know, that sort of thing, you're going to be looking at Mod Security. It's a free open source version, runs on Apache. You might try URL Scan by Microsoft. And then, so those will run on the web server. If you're looking more appliance, you need real enterprise grade and speed, there's going to be F5 with their Application Security Manager. That's the one that White Hat has integrated with Sentinel. There's Imperva has seen very well and some good reviews out there. And also Citrix has a web application firewall as well. And last one is Cisco just recently entered into the market also.
Do you have any favorite product in the space? I mean, I know Gartner's got its, what do they call it? Their magic quadrant. Do you have a mystic triangle or a, what's another word?
Magic triangle, but what I do get to do is I get to ask all our customers what products they're looking at and which ones they like, and I do that because I want to know which ones are the best and the ones I should be working with within our products. So when we reached out, you know, we saw a lot of positives around Mod Security and Apache, not only because the price, configuration and power, but that there wasn't an additional box, so people like that. And then the people also seemed to like the F5 one because it had a strong web application firewall, but it was also really sophisticated, but that it also was on the load balancer itself, meaning they already had an existing load balancer, probably a big IP by F5, and they can put some additional software on it and put that on there. So we ask around and, you know, which ones people like the best. So, Cisco's just getting into the market and Imperva's there as well, and they're making headway. And, the overall market is very, very small. There's probably, if you had to guess, 1,000 to 2,000 deployments worldwide right now among the top tier players. So it's very early on.
Can you actually elaborate on what you've done with the F5 box and why it's actually useful for customers?
So one of the things we get to measure at Whitehat is, you know, when vulnerabilities are found in our customers' websites, when we find them, and also measure them over time is when they get closed. And it's a very time-consuming, it's a very lengthy process. You know, best-case scenario, SQL injection will have an average time-to-fix window of 138 days, more than enough time to get hacked. So one of the things we've done, instead of going after the positive security model on a web application firewall that are tough and unwieldy to manage a lot of times, we looked at it in a negative security way. We say, we know where the vulnerability is, we know in the URL, we know in the parameter. Let's send that information into the web application firewall and say, do not allow SQL injection attacks in this very particular part of the website, and give the security guy some temporary relief where he is able to then communicate to developers and allow them time to fix it without having to do the fire drill. And it's something that has been very exciting among our customer base.
So it's really a quick way of mitigating stuff.
Yes, absolutely. It's a mitigation. Still should be fixed in the code, but if that still is an option, great, fix the code when you're able to. If not, then at least you have something there helping you out.
So are these web application firewalls, are they actually stateful? So they require A, B, and then C to happen before an alert gets triggered, or are they just like really pattern matching devices?
It depends on how they're deployed. I think a lot of them are mostly deployed in pattern matching mode. There's one request, one attack, and you get an alert. There usually isn't a multi-step process.
Mm.
Some of them do some application profiling, but I think it's very limited still.
But I suppose, you know, as a mitigation, it would be easier to put this sort of stuff into your web application firewall instead of into a network-based IPS, for example, because it's custom-built for web stuff, right?
Yes, though the industries are going to merge, I would expect in the next year or two for the traditional network IDSs to turn into super HTTP parsers and do the same thing as a web application firewall.
Yeah.
There's no reason to constantly separate the two. They'll blend together.
We had Greg Shipley on the show a while ago, CTO of NeoHapsis, who was saying, you know, that's a phenomenon in security, is that when you get these new innovations popping up, typically then they don't wind up being standalone products. They wind up actually being features of other products that are related to them.
That's absolutely right, because usually you have a bunch of startups that come in that do very innovative work to try to address a particular point problem in a unique way, so you get a best-of-breed solution. Then the best-of-breed solution would get snapped up by a larger player and turned into a feature. It's just the nature of the industry.
Okay, Jeremiah, thanks again for coming on to Risky Business again.
My pleasure, as always.
That was web application hacker and Bay Area Aussie Rules star Jeremiah Grossman with a look at web application firewalls. It's time now for this week's sponsor interview with Checkpoint Software's engineering manager, Steve McDonald. And this week we're asking why bringing your own computer into the office is still a bad idea in this day and age. Why is it still taboo? Even corporate-supplied laptops can miss patches when they're kept at home and offline for long enough, and they can be compromised. So, really, what's the difference? Here's an interview I recorded with Steve last week.
Yeah, look, I wouldn't say they're currently allowing it, but I'd say they're considering it, and it's not just limited, certainly, to the banking sectors. It is an interesting proposition that changes a lot of security tenets, but you kind of look at it and go, well, you know, Gen Y wanting to bring their MacBooks into work, you can understand it at some level. So, yeah, that delivers a whole lot of new challenges to a lot of organisations.
Well, I've heard rumblings actually coming from the States from some mates who work at various security vendors who've actually said, yeah, finally, because heaps of people want to bring in their MacBook Pros, they've actually changed the company policy. So you actually have to buy the equipment yourself. They can't actually get it as approved equipment, but they can actually bring it in. And it's like a pilot program, but it seems to be happening more and more. And it seems to be that Macs are increasingly the reason that these policy changes are popping up. Is that what you've seen?
Well, there's two things there. I think, obviously, Macintosh currently, I think they've got about 6% of the market, and that's grown, you know, quite considerably recently. But the other thing is that, you know, when you get your corporate laptop, it's fairly stuffy. It might not have a webcam, might not have a number of other things that you would like in your asset. If you can go out and source a cheaper piece of hardware yourself and bring it to work, then that's a very interesting proposition. And for the enterprise or the organization, they don't have to, you know, they don't have to buy the asset. They don't have an asset on their books, which looks a lot better for senior management.
Yeah, I didn't think of it that way, but it sort of does make sense, doesn't it? So, Steve, under these potential policy changes, who's actually responsible for maintaining the security of that endpoint?
Yeah, look, that's where we're starting to see people looking at just big, dirty VLANs with a user population or an untamed user population, and really turning those laptops into thin client type machines.
Yeah, okay, so putting them on an insecure segment.
Yeah, pretty much. Lock them down, make sure they can't get access.
I love the way you said that, by the way, a big dirty VLAN. It's the perfect description.
It is indeed. You wouldn't want to hang out there too long with a laptop. But
no, it sounds like a really bad neighbourhood within a bad neighbourhood.
Indeed. So, yeah, obviously it's going to bring a lot of cost savings to business, but it's not without its challenges. And obviously it'll make this thin client mentality is probably the cleanest way to get through the problems. You can have the clientless security scans, on-demand security scanning. For example, Checkpoint does that as well as a number of other vendors. So we'll download ActiveX with Java code. We'll run a scan over the endpoint that's persistent and runs regularly whilst connected. And then when they disengage or disconnect, then either that will disappear or it can be made persistent as well.
Don't you see a problem, though, with conditioning users to consistently say yes to an ActiveX pop-up, even if it is a legit one?
Well, that's the challenge. Obviously, they will be prompted, whether it be Java or ActiveX, and it's more about user education. Even if we're going to go into this unknown world of people bringing their own IT assets, there still has to be procedures and policies, and it will always come down to educating users' best practice.
But I suppose, look, on the thin client thing, so really it's going to be about scanning for known key loggers, isn't it, and using a few generic detection techniques.
Yeah, look, you're going to have some base policies set for these type of users. You must have antivirus, or you might have a specific security suite that you're going to mandate has to be on the box. There's going to have to be some degree of control. What you need to be able to do is verify before you gain access that those controls are met. And if they are, then at least you'd have a reasonably known quantity when they're connecting in.
Well, look, I mean, we've always assumed that endpoints, even if they are managed by an organization themselves, we've always assumed that endpoints are certified pre-pwned in the first place. So even when you're dealing with the company's official sealed, stamped, Lenovo ThinkPad, The assumption has always been that it's a disaster anyway, and probably chucking it on a dirty VLAN is a good idea in the first place, right?
Well, some organisations went down that path many years ago when I was working over in Europe. A couple of organisations I was dealing with that back in 2001, 2002 had already made that kind of stance. Mm. Had all their employees as well, your remote workers.
So, look, it just really comes down to scanning the endpoints for known threats, which you're going to do with your corporate laptops anyway, because you're assuming that some idiot middle manager has taken it home and left it off the internet for days and days and days while a Patch Tuesday rolls out all of these, patches for really serious vulnerabilities that are since exploited, and then he plugs it into the internet, gets owned, brings it back in. It's out of policy, it's insecure anyway, so we're just going to assume the same thing's happening with his MacBook Pro, so we may as well just provision thin client access to endpoints that go external to the organization anyway.
Yeah, look, there's a number of things we can do on top of that, including things like strong authentication, giving them different access depending on how they're connecting and what resources they're connecting from.
So allowing them raw access to their Oracle daemon at the core of the enterprise, from raw TCP access to that daemon, probably not such a good idea.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay. All right, Steve. Well, look, I think that's going to cover that one off nicely, mate. So thank you again for coming on to Risky Business.
Thank you very much for having me, Patrick. Gumball, I love the way you
dance, samba. Take some advice. That was Steve McDonald there with this week's sponsor interview, and he is, of course, from Checkpoint Software, our sponsor for this week, and a very long-term sponsor, so thanks again to Checkpoint. And that brings us to the close of this week's edition of Risky Business. This week's Sound Foundation track is Mambo Italiano, performed by Glass. These guys are quite a fun band, I think. And you can buy that track for $1.40 from soundfoundation.com. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.
Italiano è mambo, mambo, Italiano go, 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 you mixed up Sicilian. Oh, you Calabrese, do the mambo like a crazy.